continue a public hearing on House Bill 2210, the biofuels bill. And at approximately 1:45, that's my goal, is to close the hearing on House Bill 2210 and open up hearings on House Bill 2211, the business energy tax credit, and 2212, the residential energy tax credit. So if you haven't already signed up, please do. If you're already invited testimony, you don't have to sign up. And then please make sure that we get that sign-up sheet for all those bills. I also want to mention that we are honored to have in our midst today Chairman Ron Seppa. He is with the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation, and he will give the opening testimony on House Bill 2211 and 2212 as soon as we close the biofuels hearing. So I want to thank, I don't see the chairman
there yet.
So I think he'll be with us shortly.
He's in the building.
I also want to thank everybody who has been very patient with us. This is our third day of hearings. We hope to wrap up today. And if you do have handouts, just remember to give it to the assistant when you come forward to speak. And so I'm very honored to have Senator Nelson with us, who has asked to speak on this bill. And Senator Nelson, thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator. I live in Pendleton, but I represent four counties in eastern Oregon, northeast Oregon, Morrow County, Umatilla County Union, and Wallowa County. My purpose here today is just to add some more information. I think there's two major trends that are going on and that are going to need to be addressed both politically and just dealing with where we're going in the state. One is global warming, and the other is population growth, and I think that's an historical basis. That's what's happened at all times. If you go back to Malthus and some of those people, it's global warming and population growth. So my point here is, how can the Oregon farmer help? How can the legislature help me as a farmer? I am a farmer in my real life. The Oregon farmer could solve a lot of these problems. There's some things that are going to have to be done in order for that to happen, though. Right now, the Oregon farmer is able to raise 250 different crops. And so if we're talking about biofuels, and I'm talking mainly about canola, and I do have some canola here that this is actually grown on the Nelson farm about 10 years ago, and I would like to have grown more of this, but because of drought and the conditions and the difficulty of raising this crop on dry land ground, I have not been able to raise it in the last 10 years. So the issue here to me is, how do you incent the grower to grow this? And I think it's all going to be driven by economics, or a lot of it will be. Some of the things that you're talking about is tax credits and things of those nature are all very important. The highest value of canola oil is cooking oil. It's not for diesel. It's not for biodiesel. So you're going to be competing with several other crops. In my particular part of the country, and I've taken this from a presentation made by a man by the name of Bob Hale, who's a farmer in our area, an irrigated farmer. The crops he grows are onions, potatoes, sweet corn, green peas, sugar snaps, lima beans, carrots, asparagus, and bell peppers. So canola is going to be in competition with all those, and while a lot of the farmers are going to do the right thing, they're also going to have to pay the bills, and so they're going to be in competition for that. The Willamette Valley farmers have some issues as far as growing canola. They consider it a weed. Eastern Oregon farmers, where I live, we can do it. We're going to have water out of the Columbia River in order to do that. So I want to make a connection with that. We can do that, but we need water to do it. The real answer, I think, in this whole situation is forest cellulose and waste from farms. This plant grows 6 feet tall. There's a huge amount of stock that we could be using for alternative energy. To me, it's a combination of things. And I guess the last point I'd like to make is the fact that Oregon has 17 million acres of what they call for cropland, but there's only 4 million acres that are cultivated. And if you want to build a plant that's going to benefit Oregon and Oregon farmers so that we can raise enough, you're going to have to put more land under production or else put it under water production. Very difficult crop to raise. I hope that you consider the connectivity of everything that's involved with this, and I appreciate the opportunity to make a quick presentation and hope that you can get on with your committee.
Thank you so much, Senator Nelson. Do you want to stick around for a minute in case there's questions?
Sure, there's
many of the colleagues here. Any questions for the senator? Thank you so much.
Okay,
appreciate
you.
It.
Yeah.
Okay, next I'm going to call up a panel. We're going to have a couple of panels and try to work through this quickly. Unfortunately, there were several people who couldn't testify on Friday because we ran out of time, so I'm going to call up Kevin Considine from the Oregon Environmental Council, John Ledger from the Association of Oregon Industries, and Greg Remensberger from the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Is Greg here? Okay, so instead of Greg, we'll have Lisa Dotto from the Oregon Business Association. Okay, so we're striking out again. And I also see that, let's see, we have, is John Miller here? John, come on up. John is with Mahonia Nurseries, and we'll seek out the other folks. So, Kevin, if you want to get started, and please remember to state your name for the record. Thank you for your patience.
Chair Dinkfelder and members of the committee, I'm Kevin Considine, Sustainable Economy Program Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. I reside at 1334 Southeast 23rd in Portland. As OEC's coordinator of the Biofuels Network, I also do a lot of work in that realm as well. I'm also a board member of the newly formed Northwest Biofuels Association, a new trade association that's interested in trying to make sure that this is done the right way. We think it's long overdue to have a trade association, so we're pretty excited about where we're going with things there. The Oregon Biofuels Network, which is sponsored by OEC, is a loose affiliation of biofuel stakeholders around Oregon. It serves as a clearinghouse of information on biofuels-related topics. The network has a listserv of over 450 Oregonians, of which there are several members of in this room, I believe, that are actually on board with that. And That provides us with a great deal of information about what's going on with biofuels, not only here in the Northwest, but also around the world. The network also helps to raise the public awareness of the benefits of biodiesel and ethanol, identify opportunities on ways to expand the markets, and works to break down barriers to biofuels production in Oregon. In addition to this work with the Oregon Biofuels Network, OEC conducted a biofuels cluster analysis in conjunction with the Oregon Business Association. During that cluster analysis, we surveyed biofuel stakeholders and held biofuels on the farm workshops. It's clear that a robust local biofuels industry can be a driver for economic development and greater energy independence in Oregon while improving our environment. That is why we are supportive of House Bill 2210, 2211, and 2212. Today, Oregonians spend billions of dollars each year for energy from fossil fuels. When Oregonians spend a dollar on gasoline or diesel, we send that dollar out of state on a finite, non-renewable resource. However, when we spend a dollar on biodiesel or ethanol, we support a cleaner, renewable resource that can be produced locally. These dollars are reinvested in our local economy, making Oregon communities stronger by expanding markets for Oregon growers, expanding new economic opportunity for Oregon businesses, and new jobs for Oregon workers. Renewable fuels also make our communities and our state healthier. Biodiesel is healthier than petroleum diesel, which remains the number one air toxin in the state of Oregon. Biodiesel results in cleaner air, curbing air pollution through reduced emissions of particulate matter, air toxics, carbon monoxide, and sulfur dioxides all across the board. Ethanol is also a cleaner-burning renewable fuel blended with gasoline to reduce carbon monoxide pollution and exhaust pollutants that contribute to smog. Cleaner renewable fuels not only translate into healthier air, but also a reduction in emissions that lead to global warming. Biodiesel results in a 78% life cycle reduction in carbon dioxide, a primary contributor to global warming. Each gallon of corn ethanol used in a 10% blend with gasoline cuts greenhouse gas emissions by 12 to 19%. Beyond the environmental impacts, there is a tremendous opportunity for Oregon to be a leader in the development of renewable fuels and to partner with growers and entrepreneurs to build a prosperous biofuels industry in our state and all along the West Coast. Biodiesel can be crushed from an oilseed crop such as canola, mustard, which are locally grown here in Oregon. When farmers participate in the crushing operations that transform these oilseed crops into oil, they add value to their crop, providing them with an additional income stream. And value-added crops are one thing that we really want to see happen here in Oregon. Meanwhile, 25% of U.S. corn exports flow through the Pacific Northwest ports, giving Oregon a near-term opportunity to capture part of that flow for in-state ethanol processing, while breakthroughs in cellulosic ethanol can help to transform the market. new oilseed crushing and biofuels facilities in Oregon would spur economic growth, especially in rural Oregon, generating new job growth during construction and during operations, as we've seen in Washington State. Oregon has the potential to play a leadership role in developing our own robust renewable fuels industry. Other states are aggressively pursuing policies to gain a competitive edge. If Oregon is to do the same, the state must look at enacting our own innovative policies and incentives. And undertaking that task, we believe it's fundamentally important to show how Oregon can benefit from biofuels. We believe House Bill 2210 and 2211 and 2212 are a means to provide the best benefits in Oregon. In 2005, Oregon conducted a survey of biofuel stakeholders to find out how they would rank various options for moving the industry forward and what additional suggestions that they had. 152 biofuel stakeholders participated in this survey, and one quarter of those who responded were growers and farmers from the area. The survey covered a number of different topics, including concepts for legislation, and it included questions on how best to support growers in using biodiesel, producing biodiesel feedstocks, and getting involved in biodiesel processing. We found that survey respondents strongly agreed that incentives are needed to produce the local feedstocks, such as oilseed crops, and develop crushing and processing facilities and operations, much as Senator Nelson mentioned earlier. A large number of respondents expressed the need for a stable market for these products. A national RFS does nothing to provide Oregon with any cleaner fuels. House Bill 2210 provides a production tax credit for farmers to grow biodiesel feedstocks and encourages on-farm crushing and processing. We do believe that a production credit should be increased from $1 to $8 per million BTUs of biodiesel, as has been testified to earlier by both, I believe Katie Fass mentioned that, as well as Ken Madison. House Bill 2210 encourages the use of cleaner alternative fuel vehicles through income tax credits for those who burn higher blends of biodiesel and ethanol in their cars and trucks. House Bill 2211, which would expand Oregon's existing business energy tax credit, is an important incentive for bolstering the renewable fuels industry and achieving the important economic development benefits biofuels have to offer. Even with incentives targeted toward local production, the need for a stable market for their product, the need for a stable market is essential. As you heard from Senator Jhené Holmquist from Washington State, Washington joined Minnesota in pursuing a renewable fuel standard as a way of aggressively tapping into the biofuels market and ensuring market stability necessary to garner needed investment. An RFS has been demonstrated in states like Minnesota and Washington to provide market drivers and stability with clear economic benefits, new investments, and new jobs. It can also serve to guarantee a future market for emerging clean fuel technologies like cellulosic ethanol that require local feedstocks, which are abundant here in Oregon. Since Minnesota enacted a renewable fuel standard in 1997, renewable fuels production have resulted in over $1 billion worth of economic benefits and supported over 5,000 jobs. Since Washington State passed its RFS last year, new biofuels processing facilities are slated to go online, capable of bringing to market 470 million gallons of renewable fuels. We support the renewable fuel standard that would be established under 2210. We believe it is designed to work best for economic development in Oregon, with blending targets tied to feedstock production and processing capacity in Oregon and the Northwest region. We believe this will allow for growers and refiners to develop capacity and infrastructure necessary to be a strong participant in the market. We believe that an RFS mandate gets goals accomplished. House Bill 2210 will also ensure that Oregonians have access to cleaner fuels at the pump that promote cleaner air and a healthy environment, a value all Oregonians share. We believe that House Bill 2210 should include a prohibition on palm oil because of the lower quality fuel stock and feedstock that it provides, and it has also has some fairly significant damaging impacts to the global environment. We hope the committee will support 2210 and 2211 as a strong tool to drive new investment in production of Oregon biofuels that will be key to the future in our future in energy independence, economic development, and a clean environment for all of Oregon. We hope the committee will move quickly to pass 2210 and 2211. And for the clerk, I do have some copies of the business cluster analysis that we did.
Great, thank you. Okay, John Ledger.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Vice President of Associated Oregon Industries, the state's largest business association. I'll be very brief. I've been listening these last couple of days, and there's been more discussion of biofuels than I ever thought was conceivable. We support the use of biofuels. We think it's a great opportunity for economic growth, a new growth expansion in Oregon. I just have a couple of quick comments. There's been quite a bit of discussion about clean air. There's an additional economic benefit to that other than just being healthy, and that is as the air gets cleaner, it allows for more industrial growth. Just because of the way the Clean Air Act is structured, it allows you to get some more increments. And so the cleaner the air is, the more vitality you can have and have growth. And some places growth is actually slowed because you don't have that. It's not good for air in every city. It happens to be good for the type of pollutants and climate conditions we have in Oregon. We like to see the emphasis on cellulose. We think that's terrific. I mean, that would be a big source of help to Oregon. We have a lot of members that produce that kind of material. We would encourage the committee to maximize flexibility and minimize mandates wherever possible. I think you heard a discussion about this yesterday from Mr. Doherty, and we would just encourage you as you go through the amendments on this bill and discuss the bill further that you look, if possible, to reduce the mandates wherever you can. We just think that allows more market flexibility and is a good idea. To tell you the truth, it warms my heart to sit beside OEC and hear them pitching tax credits for business, and especially such big ones. And I would just point out that this is a great economic boon for the state. This is going to attract companies. It's going to retain companies. We have a lot of businesses in the state that are undergoing a lot of trauma, in danger of closing their doors, competition. And certainly if this works for biofuels and ethanol, the same economic package, economic approach, would work to keeping current companies we have now employing current Oregonians, helping them save their jobs. So with that, we would ask you to take whatever look you need to take at this bill. Please bear in mind the comments and the good comments we've had so far, and we're very supportive. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ledger, and it warms my heart to have you here testifying in support of the bill today. So with that, Mr. Miller, thank you for being here. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm John Miller, president of Wildwood Mahoney, a group of companies in Salem that have done a lot of energy and environment-related projects over the last 25 years in Oregon. Our company developed the first Energy Star Earth Advantage residential community here in the Mid-Valley. Our office is an award-winning building that was built energy efficient before LEED existed, and we're currently involved in some projects in China, one of which is an ethanol plant near the North Korean border with an architect named Wayne McDonough. And over there, they've stalled on some of their best biofuels feedstock opportunities, being sweet sorghum, by not being able to decide whether sorghum is a food crop, or an energy crop, when it actually is both. So I'm hoping that 2010 and its associated bills will get us off dead center in terms of some of those issues. We're the planner and developer for Mill Creek Junction, which is an energy and environmentally oriented development here in Salem, which is currently where the Sequential Pacific Biodiesel Plant is located. And in that sense, we'll be host to Sequential Pacific's expansion, which is coming over the next few years. And in developing such a project, you find that innovative folks kind of band together, much like they do in the high-tech industry. And we're looking at a company that may want to move their energy-related R&D here to the Salem area to be next to that plant. But you also find that the capital is a huge need for such enterprises. And I'm an investor in the Sequential Pacific plant, as is Cameron Healy of Kettle Foods. We both are investing, I don't know whether mainly or partly, because we believe in it and believe in its value for Oregon and the planet. But we need to get to the point where energy production is an attractive investment to Main Street folks like venture capitalists and others who don't have that green bent. And I think the renewable fuel standard will jumpstart that a great deal. In the innovation arena, I think cellulosic ethanol isn't there yet, but we may attract some people that would make that happen faster. And in fact, we need to concentrate, I think, in the beginning on what's possible. Biodiesel, ethanol are both possible. I'm also a farmer. We own Mahonia Vineyards and Nursery, and we've been using biodiesel for several years now. We really would appreciate the tax credit that 2010 involves for biofuels users, because at this point we pay more for biodiesel than we would for regular diesel, and a lot of people just can't afford to do that, and the tax credit I think would help a great deal. Also, like the feedstock tax credit, it would make Oregon farmers more competitive with out-of-state producers of feedstock, and frankly, biodiesel produced from local feedstocks is a lot more energy efficient than mile long trains from the Midwest or palm oil coming from Indonesia. Lastly, I'm long experienced in land use in terms of getting projects cited and meandering the way through often what is a circuitous path in terms of regulations. I've been involved in the last few months in trying to get an ethanol production facility that uses local feedstock sited in the Willamette Valley. The first thing you find is that many zones simply do not allow it. And then you find also that those that do allow it often involve so many hoops and opportunities for folks to stop the process that it can take years to get there. So currently either you can't even apply or you would be silly to do so in many areas. We need safeguards, but I will really urge that you adopt the expedited facility siting provision of 2010, and I support the legislation wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. Are there any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, I do have a quick question, thank you, of Kevin from mm-hmm. OEC. You mentioned something about the amount of corn that's currently passing through Oregon on its way to shipment, presumably to other parts of the world. What, I missed the number or the figure associated with that.
Sure. Representative Dingfield, Representative Cannon, it's about 25% of the Pacific Northwest feedstocks for corn is coming through the Port of Portland and other areas. So it's a pretty significant. Most of that is headed for Asian markets, et cetera, which is why you're seeing a lot more of the siting of the ethanol plants right along the railroad lines there, both for Chuck Carlson's facility as well as for Port of Morrow, as well as Pacific Ethanol.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel?
Yes.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How long, I guess, Mr. Miller,
Mr.
How
Mr.
long are these, tax credits going to be needed for? And what happens if and when the price of petrodiesel declines? Do you need more tax credits then?
Well, I don't expect that to happen real soon, but it would. The Chinese, one of the things that they do, which makes sense, is they vary their subsidies as a function of the price of petroleum, and it would seem to me that that would make a lot of sense.
Okay, that would then be kind of editorializing a question too. I assume that would be your recommendation for the legislature as far as a legislative concept to put the tax credit on some sort of basis with the differential between petroleum and biodiesel.
I think that makes sense. I think you also have to recognize that these things cycle slowly as well as vary day by day, and the predictability is a huge factor in terms of investment. But I think it makes sense in the long run.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you so much for your time. Okay, I'm going to try again for, I don't see Lisa Dotto unless she's snuck in. And then also Greg Remensberger. Okay, so we'll move on to the next panel of folks who have signed up. And I have down Brian Harris from Harris Transportation, I also have, Kim Pusey, is that, how do you say her name?
Pusey,
from Port of Umatilla. And I have Dave Stewart-Smith with Pacific Energy Systems. If you could all come up, very much appreciate that. And actually, the last person that we have is John Charles. So, John, if you want to pull up an extra chair, you just have to fight over the microphones, but hopefully you can share. Mr. Harris, if you're ready to go, do you want to get started? That would be wonderful.
I am. Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Harris. I'm president of Harris Transportation Company. We're a 75-year-old family-operated business, leader in the petroleum transportation business in the Northwest. We also are a user of over 500,000 gallons of diesel fuel every year. And I am also serving as the chairman of the Oregon Trucking Association. I would like to briefly give you some background on the Oregon industry in transportation. Let me move this over here. The trucking industry is the foundation of the Oregon economy. Oregon's trucking industry currently transports over 70% of the tons of freight in the state. As we like to say it, if you got it, a truck brought it. In 2004, 106,000 jobs, or 1 in 14, Oregonians were employed in the trucking industry. In my company, Harris Transportation, we employ over 100 professional truck drivers and administrative staff within the state of Oregon. Total trucking industry wages in Oregon exceed $4 billion, with an average salary of $38,000. With this type of infrastructure in place, our industry, of course, is a major diesel user. The Oregon Trucking Association supports the development of renewable fuels in Oregon, including biodiesel. We believe that reducing carbon dioxide emissions, which are a byproduct of the combustion of fossil fuels such as petroleum diesel, is a very positive step in addressing concerns about global warming. We are more than willing to do our part. We are currently using biodiesel when it is price advantageous and as an additive to increase the lubricity of the ultra-low sulfur diesel. It is important to note that the major engine manufacturers have approved the use of biodiesel made to ASTM specs in concentrates of 5% or less in our current truck engines. Therefore, we support the basic premise of House Bill 2210 with a couple exceptions. Most of the problems we have encountered with biodiesel when used in concentrations of 5% or less are a result of the fuel that does not meet the ASTM specifications. We are very much appreciative of the efforts of the chair, the governor's staff, and the Department of Agriculture to implement a rigorous biodiesel testing protocol to ensure the quality of the product. We also appreciate the willingness to engage in educational efforts to prepare the owners of the storage tanks for the use of biodiesel. These efforts should dramatically reduce, if not preclude, any problems with the quality of biodiesel sold in the state. However, we do have a concern with one of the provisions in the bill. Our experience with fuel mandates is that they tend to increase the price of fuel. For example, in California has used a unique diesel fuel formulation for some time that we refer to as CARB diesel. On the average, CARB diesel is more expensive than diesel sold in other western states. The cost of the fuel is the second largest cost category incurred by trucking companies. A slight increase in fuel costs has a significant impact on the trucking companies, on the trucking company industry. It also can have an impact on the economy as we have to pass those costs along to our customers. It is our preference that the mandate to use biodiesel be deleted from House Bill 2210. Our only other concern is that any major Is that any fuel standards adopted should be at a minimum at the state level. For the same reason that we are concerned about a state mandate, we are equally concerned about local governments adopting their own diesel fuel standards and the impact that they may have on fuel price. We respectfully request you consider a new provision in the House Bill 2210, which would prohibit local governments from implementing their own unique fuel standards. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk with you today. This concludes my prepared testimony.
Thank you so much. And we have, committee member, you should have a copy of the testimony in front of you from Mr. Harris. Thank you. Mr. Kuzis? Go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm Kim Pusey. I'm general manager of the Port of Umatilla. I'm not here because of the port. I'm here because I have a background in biofuels. In 1981, I started a company in New Mexico called Cellulose International Corporation. So I've had an interest in cellulosic ethanol for more than 25 years. I support any research and development dollars that could go towards cellulosic ethanol. I also, in the early 80s to mid 80s in New Mexico, worked in the development, design, construction, and operation of 11 commercial ethanol facilities. I don't have to remind you of the cycle that we go through in these alternative fuels, which is that the price of fossil fuels go up, the consumers complain, the legislature induces an industry into the state, the price of fuel goes back down, and the inducements sunset, and the industry collapses. That happens about every generation. I hope that we won't make that mistake in Oregon, and that you'll be careful and modest in how you go about inducing this particular industry. With respect to ethanol, one of the most grave concerns that I have as a citizen of the state is that we have a product, anhydrous ethanol is 112 octane, and at the pump, you always find 87 to 91 octane. In order to bring that 112 down, we have to have low-grade blend components that come from gasoline refineries, of which the state of Oregon has none. So you have to bring blend components from the closest refineries, which there are 6 in Washington, 21 in California, 5 in Utah, 9 in Idaho, 9 in Oregon. In order for ethanol to work as a blend component, then, in Oregon blended fuels, you're going to have to be bringing in lower-grade blend component from states where they have those gasoline refineries. That's one issue. The second are the enormous plants that are being proposed. For each daily gallon of production in an ethanol plant, you have 6 pounds of distiller's grain. So, for example, on a very tiny plant, a million-gallon-a-year plant, if you're operating 330 days a year, or about 3,000 gallons a day, you'd have to have 3,000 live cattle proximate to that plant. If you're talking about a 10-million-gallon-a-year plant, 30,000 cattle. 100-million-gallon-a-year plant, which we throw that number around a lot as if it's easy, have to have 300,000 cattle. Let me remind you, there are 1.4 million cows and calves in the state of Oregon, 1.1 in the state of Washington, total of 2.5 million. So it isn't very long until you easily overwhelm the market in the Pacific Northwest for the distiller's grains on an ethanol plant. On biodiesel, the numbers are even larger with respect to the canola meal. If I can give you just a few numbers, and I want to say that the dog that I have in this fight is a 5 million gallon a year biodiesel plant that you've heard a lot about from Kent Madison, Al Goshak, and others, Randy Leonard. That's the project I support. That's the size I support. In eastern Oregon, we can do, we have rotation acreage available for about plus or minus 5 million gallons a year of canola production. If we do it at that scale, that size plant puts out about 242,000 pounds of canola meal a day. So if you're feeding 6 pounds a day, you need to have 40,000 cows around. If you're feeding 1 pound a day, you have to have 242,000 cows. There are two business models out there. One is what I call this appropriate-sized local model that has to do with offering the inducements to the producers of the feedstocks, a disposable market such as the Portland metro area, maybe public fleets, buses, school districts, port districts, and so forth that could use this locally produced product. The other model has to do with huge infrastructure, imported feedstocks, exported co-products, and certainly some issues on ethanol with respect to blend components. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that any of the members of the committee have. And that concludes my testimony.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Mr. Stewart-Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Stewart-Smith. I'm with Pacific Energy Systems in Portland. Madam Chair, I'm appearing today on behalf of Pacific Energy Systems, an engineering, energy consulting, and project management firm. Pacific Energy Systems supports House Bill 2210 as an important addition to the tools Oregon has at its disposal to encourage the development of renewable energy infrastructure. 40% of Oregon's energy use goes for transportation fuel, and currently all of what we spend on these fuels leaves the state. Developing our own renewable fuels industry is critical to Oregon's energy future. In addition, these fuels offset fossil fuel use and reduce our emissions of fossil-derived carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. While there is improvement needed in the technologies to produce biofuels, we can't wait to begin developing the capacity to produce these renewable fuels. Technology is rapidly improving the energy costs of producing ethanol, for example, and those states with facilities in operation will be far ahead when processes for ethanol production from cellulosic sources, such as wood waste, agricultural residues, and waste paper, matures. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to ask John Charles and Lisa Dotto to come up, and then we'll have questions for any of the members. So if a couple of you could just step back so they can have the mic. And I did see Lisa here. There she is. She's hiding back there. I knew you were there. Thank you. Don't go too far, gentlemen, because there might be some questions. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I gave a handout to the committee assistant. And for the record, my name is John Charles, president of the Cascade Policy Institute, a free market research center in Portland. I'm happy to speak today on an issue that I've worked on for a very long time. As the chair knows, I was head of the Oregon Environmental Council from 1980 to 1996 and spent thousands of hours of my professional life working especially in air pollution issues. And I would like to provide a little context, historical context, for the discussion, because policy advocates and elected officials have a tendency to see doom and gloom everywhere on this front. And I understand that there are institutional reasons why bad news is good and good news is bad for some people and institutions. But if you just look at Oregon's air quality data summaries from DEQ that I provided you, you see nothing but good news. And I'm personally thrilled that this has happened, that I had some small role in this and working on all these issues back in the 80s. And you look everywhere across the state for almost any parameter, CO, NOx, PM10, Southern Oregon, the Valley, Eastern Oregon, constantly declining trends, and these are going to continue indefinitely because of technological innovation. So it's certainly true that biodiesel, for instance, would move us even further down that slope, but it's not as if we're starting from a place of crisis. We're in a very good place already, and regardless of what you do, these trends will continue. The next page looks at the energy intensity issue for motor vehicles. And again, there's interesting news that's good and bad. And this is part of my point that I want to make today as to why I'm concerned, not only for the current bill in front of you, but all three bills, the problems with subsidies and mandates. If you look at the energy intensity of automobiles, which are mostly, which exist in very cutthroat competitive markets, you see from 1970 to 2002, a steady decline in energy intensity either by vehicle mile or passenger mile. You see the same thing for light trucks. Again, this is great news. This is going to continue. There's intense competition. Actually, when you look at the transit sector, a sector since 1964, characterized primarily by massive government subsidies, and local monopolistic transit agencies immune from competition by law, you see the exact reverse trend. From 1970 from 1970 to 2002, the annual average percentage increase in energy intensity for transit was 0.5 and 1.6, depending on which parameter, the steady increase. You go to the next table, and you see again, intercity Amtrak, rail transit, bad news. Decade after decade after decade, they're all monopolies. They're all subsidized. I think there's a message there. And the final page is a data-rich page, and which if you're a real geek, you can spend a long time analyzing it, and I've had fun doing that. But I would call your attention just for the minute to the three right-hand columns that I've highlighted on your copies. Energy consumption per dollar of GDP, which is, to me, the most appropriate way to measure what we're doing. It's how much energy do you consume per unit of economic output. And that column, the next column, greenhouse gas emissions per dollar of GDP, and the far right column, carbon dioxide emissions. Nothing but good news. An incredible steady decline. The economy has become twice as efficient in the last 30 years. And again, the trend keeps continuing. So my cautionary note for 2210 and the rest of them is I think it's hubris for any of us to think that we understand the economy well enough to intervene. What some people refer to as market stabilization is just a fancy word for a government-created cartel. And everybody in the room who has a dog in this race, they're just looking for you to set some rules, and then they'll game the system. They're always going to game the system, and they want you to set up a barrier to entry or regulation that harms others and benefits them. That's what always happens when out of the private economy when you intervene. And none of us are prescient enough to know what's going to happen, but we do know from experience. For instance, when President Carter talked about the malaise back in 79, we did the whole big Synfuels Corporation project. And from 1970 to 84, we dumped in $2 billion into a black hole. Never panned out. There was a time when supersonic transport was a big international competition. We put $920 million into the SST. Nothing to show for it. And of course, the electric vehicle mandate in California. And these might have been well-intentioned, but basically some people make a lot of money, and all of us as taxpayers pay the freight. I'd say if tax credits are a good idea, they're a good idea across the board. Great, let's lower the corporate tax rate. Let's abolish it. But don't allow rent-seeking companies to come in and get a good deal somewhere. I would say one of the things that hurts the industry, especially for biodiesel, I think there's great potential for tiny little entities to enter the market and sell locally. But right now, you have to register with the EPA. You face fines of potentially $25,000 a day. And you're going down the path of creating a biodiesel and ethanol oligopoly. I think it's the wrong path. We should promote many, many small producers. My final point, I guess, is it's been mentioned earlier, but it's very likely that ethanol has minimal environmental energy gains anyway. This month, Scientific American has a wonderful overview with all kinds of cool color graphics on this subject, which I was tempted to make copies for you in color, but it would have cost me about $88, and I didn't want to violate your ethics standards of gifts to legislators. So, but I will just say there are two points here from the issue that are worth acknowledging, which is it says, although politicians are aggressively pushing ethanol from homegrown corn as a substitute for foreign oil, the conversion makes little energy sense. It requires copious amounts of fossil fuels. Secondly, studies show that producing ethanol from corn creates almost the same amount of greenhouse gas as gasoline production does. Burning ethanol in vehicles offers little, if any, pollution reduction. Now, among the stat heads who study this, there's a raging debate about do we actually consume more energy in making ethanol than we get out the back end, and I am not one of those people intimately in the debate, but I know it's out there, and I think the best thing you can do is stay out of it, let the market actors risk private equity on this, and those who lose, they lose their own equity. Those who gain, they gain, and the rest of us taxpayers, we just, we ride the wave. But when you intervene, our tax money is likely to go down a rat hole somewhere. So those are just some cautionary notes that I urge you to consider. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. And Lisa, thank you for being here.
Thank you for giving me some flexibility about it. My name is Lisa Adato, and I'm from the Oregon Business Association, and I'm here to testify in support of HB 2210. And I have many of the same comments that you may have heard in the past, but some new ones as well. I think one important distinction, though, is that the OBA isn't in this industry per se.
That's a new one. We haven't heard that one before. Just a reminder for folks to turn off their phones and Blackberries.
Otherwise,
sort of
will
sounds like a NASCAR promotion.
I was going to say it. Okay. Otherwise, you have to explain what your ring means to the entire committee. Sorry about that.
The OBA is a mainstream business group, and we have businesses that are from many, many different kinds of industries throughout the state. And I think I gave you a list of some of them last time. You see some of our board members or our board members on the testimony. So we're not here testifying in support because it is our industry, and we see a direct gain to our own bottom line, so to speak. Rather, we're here to support because we see a gain for Oregon and for Oregon's public policy. And with that, I'd like to talk about, well, what is the business case? What are our reasons? One of the reasons is ultimately, with that word, they hold great promise. They hold promise for energy security, economic development, and jobs in Oregon, and environmental benefits. And all are important to the business climate in Oregon. Some of the economic development benefits, one of them is that, like businesses everywhere, states, cities, any entity, these days, you need a strategy in order to succeed. And we actually had, we have an Oregon business plan, and we had a professor last year, Professor Michael Porter, come and look at our plan, and he said, yeah, you've got a lot of things going in Oregon, but you don't have a strategy. And as a result of that input, business community that put together the Oregon Business Plan Strategy said, let's find a couple of things where we are in the leading edge. And one of those things, and the key area that we highlighted this year was sustainability. And renewable fuels is a hallmark of sustainability. So if that's our designated strategy, it makes sense to invest in our designated strategy rather than invest a little bit in just anything. So it's part of our strategy. Also, and we've talked about this before, there is the opportunity for direct benefit to farmers and others throughout Oregon, particularly as new technologies come along. And so that would be a direct benefit in addition to a strategic benefit. The bill creates infrastructure, including distribution and market awareness and other things for new types of fuels, and that will help us as new technologies come along. The biggest benefit is possibly in the future, because when we can use forest wastes and agricultural wastes, that will really put Oregon in the forefront as compared to now when we have a more limited amount of agricultural growth opportunity with canola oil and importation from the Midwest. But even now, we're seeing new companies, new jobs, new flexibility for farmers and forests, and increased prices that will help our farmers do better and make a living. And there are environmental benefits, as we've seen. As we've talked about, we've heard about climate change. The reality is that carbon isn't regulated yet, or isn't regulated in Oregon, isn't regulated nationally. So when we look at statistics that show that our air quality is improving, well, that's true, and that's a result of the Clean Air Act. But carbon is not included. It's not currently regulated. And one of the environmental benefits is that we, by moving to renewable fuels, we're looking to improve our carbon emissions specifically. And in addition, there's other environmental benefits. Finally, a couple of comments about implementation. If a statewide bill is passed, we think it makes sense to preempt local bills if the same needs can be met. It will be confusing for producers and consumers if multiple jurisdictions have different requirements, and we'd like to do this as expeditiously as possible. We think also it makes sense to trigger the RFS based on local production so that we make sure that our farmers and our foresters here in the Northwest can benefit. Finally, and this is a really important to many of our members, we support biofuels. We don't want to lose that piece, and we support this. We strongly support this this bill. But we also think it's important that this not be oversold, because that might result in disillusionment or cynicism. So the biofuels bill is a building block in a much larger movement. More work and other bills will be needed as well. The biofuels bill is not an immediate panacea for farmers, and it's not an immediate panacea for climate change. We know that a lot of the ethanol comes from the Midwest, not locally. It's unlikely that the biofuels bill, as we see it before us, will have a huge impact on our transportation fuels. So we want to be realistic about it. But I don't think that diminishes the importance of this bill. Moving towards renewable energy and renewable fuels is a critical and necessary piece of what we need to do. And there'll be additional impacts on forests and farmers as other things come our way. We'll ultimately need a massive investment in new technology and research and new policy, new business practices, new consumer behavior. All of this will be necessary. So the current bill is not the last word. We'll see other things, but it's a very necessary, honorable, critical first step.
Thank you. And Ivan, if you can come up here and be really, really brief. We just handed out your testimony. We have Ivan Molesky from the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club, who is the last person signed up, and I'm trying to keep us on track. So if you could just highlight the comments that you have in front of us, that would be wonderful. And for the record,
thank you, Chair Dingfelder. My name is Ivan Molesky. I'm the conservation coordinator with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. I'll be very brief. Just wanted to say that we applaud the committee and also the Revenue Committee for addressing these tough issues, promoting clean energy in Oregon, whether it's renewable fuels, renewable portfolio standards, energy conservation, and efficiency. We ultimately believe that conservation and efficiency are the best ways to get us to where we want to be here in Oregon. But I did want to say a couple of quick concerns that we've got, just to raise a couple issues for you all to consider in your deliberations over the renewable fuel standard. And first, I wanted to just say that we need to make sure that forest biomass activities, whether for electricity generation or the production of cellulosic ethanol, don't inadvertently promote unsustainable forest practices. Biomass collection from federal lands has the potential to undermine efforts to protect old-growth trees, roadless areas, and sensitive watersheds. The priority efforts for public lands management should be to remove small-diameter hazardous fuels around forest communities where the natural fire cycle has been suppressed and forest fire is a significant threat. Some limited-scale local biomass energy projects could be acceptable in these instances. Generally, however, the reliance on large areas of federal lands to supply large-scale biomass plants could create unreasonable demands for the byproducts of poor forest management and logging practices, increasing the pressure to disturb forests that actually deserve protection. And then secondly, just the last issue here is we need to be careful in promoting corn-based ethanol in Oregon, taking the time to learn from problems that have arisen in other states and other parts of the country. Corn-based ethanol can create its own pollution, including carbon monoxide, nitrous oxides, sulfur dioxide, and volatile organic compounds. Corn also is typically a very water-intensive crop, which may be not a good fit in many parts of Oregon where water issues are already pretty serious. Lastly, the widespread use of petroleum-based fertilizers for corn production, as well as chemical pesticides used, could also undermine environmental gains made by using less petroleum-derived gasoline. So as an alternative, the Sierra Club strongly favors additional incentives for canola and other oil crops for the production of biodiesel, as well as cellulosic ethanol that is derived from certain sustainable agricultural feedstocks such as switchgrass and rye. Again, we applaud you for your work on these issues. Thanks for taking the time to consider these comments in your deliberations.
Great. Thank you so much, and thank you for being patient, all of you. I am going to ask all the last two panel members to just hang out and see if there's any questions, and then see if there's any other people want to testify before we move on to the hearings on 2211 and 2212. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And if you have it directed towards a certain person, just feel free to call them.
Well, let me just put this out here and see who feels comfortable commenting on it. Last Friday, on the way home, I called folks at Bend Oil Company to kind of share what I had heard over 2 days of hearings on this bill, and And by the way, I'm very supportive of this bill and want to make sure we do this, but I just want to make sure from the implementation perspective we get it right as well. And the issue of the gel, we're okay with that. But the other two issues that they shared with me, one is the concern about having different standards in different locales. Imagine a 10,000-gallon tanker truck from Bend coming up to Portland, filling up at the rack, going home, and they have to stop at Madras, Redmond, and Bend, and they all have different standards. So from an implementation perspective, that'd be very difficult if that were the case. And then secondly, there's some concern about the underground tanks and the capacity of them. Apparently at the retail level, some stations aren't capable. They don't have the space for tanks, so they'd have to get rid of the diesel that they use now and put this in, which is okay, but there's concerns about the dyed diesel for off-road type consumption. And so I'm curious if anybody would feel comfortable commenting on that. I noticed, Mr. Harrison, your written testimony had some mention in there about the tanks.
And could you please also repeat your name for the record when you address
the question? Sure, it's Brian Harris with Harris Transportation. I guess uniquely enough, we are in the fuel petroleum transportation business, so we do see some of these operating issues potentially popping up with having different mandates or different percentages in different local areas. Your specific question on the tanks, again, is what?
Well, what's the impact at the retail level of this requirement as far as tanks? Because some of these stations, my understanding is they have as many tanks as they have space for. So you're either going to displace a current product or they're just not going to be able to do this.
Well, I suppose what would happen is they would make a business decision on if it was viable for them to sell the product, i.e. They have usually three grades of gasoline and then a diesel. If it's viable to make money selling the product, they would make sure that they had a place for to sell it. Now, if they were also selling off-road diesel, which is a whole different type of product, then they would have to choose. Then they probably wouldn't be selling the low sulfur diesel. So they do have to make some choices on what products they're going to sell.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. I guess I'd open this question up to anyone. And by the way, Kim, it's great seeing you. Welcome to the Capitol. It's always good to have someone from Eastern Oregon here. Kim, you raised a comment about the waste byproduct and its disposal, and I guess that triggered a question in me. Has anyone in this room seen an economic model on what we're talking about with hard numbers, with an analysis based upon the supply and demand of the product, based upon assumptions over a 20, 30, 40-year period? I haven't seen it. And while I support this concept, I'm worried that all I've heard over the last couple of days is a lot of sexy talk, but I haven't seen the brass tacks numbers on what we're talking about. And I guess I open that up to anyone in the audience. Please stop by my office. Bring me an economic model that shows me that what we're doing financially makes sense for the state. Because, you know, everyone needs to keep in mind, we're about to forego a lot of revenue. We're about to pass a House bill that's going to have a income tax credit, which will affect the state revenues, money that goes to our schools, that goes to our seniors, that goes to all our other needed programs. And we're also going to have a property tax exemption that's going to forego dollars to our local government. So I guess I'm just curious if we have a hard economic model, because I'll tell you what, Kim, you just raised one question, but I'm willing to bet, based on that economic model, there'd probably be a few more out there we ought to be asking.
Sure. And Representative Smith, having served on the Renewable Energy Working Group for the past year and a half, or almost 18 months, we can certainly get you that information because we did see some. Yes. And for the record, could you say
Kim Pusey.
Thank you.
The dots that I think you have to connect are the numbers of cows and what nutritionists say cows in the area can consume. And if you do that, you'll get a range from 1 pound a day of either distiller's grains or canola meal. And we're giving you the numbers on how much of that co-product you'll have, whether it's ethanol or biodiesel. And so the question on disposal locally has to do with how many cattle there are as compared to the size of the plants that you're going to induce into this state. The second part of that has to do with, and again, how you go about this policy. Most of the plants, whether they're large or small, are based on historical data on the price of the feedstock and the historical data on the prices of the finished products. Whenever you begin to produce an alternative fuel, and it's an alternative to fossil fuel that we normally consume, when the supply of that fuel goes up, it's just simple economics. When the supply of all fuel goes up, the price of all fuel will go down. When the demand for the feedstocks go up, the price of the feedstock will go up. And when the lines cross out there, that your feedstocks are going up faster than the price that you're being able to get at the pump, the people who are developing these plants will be back to you again. That's the same time that you'll have the revenue shortfalls on the transportation side, where the bridges and highways are starting to come apart and you're having to address chuck holes. So eventually down the line there, it's, are we going to fix the roads, continue to fund the schools, or are we going to go back and continue to induce this industry that we started that now has economics that are not going the direction that we anticipated them to go? And it's the cycle that you face, and do you want to spend the money for what I think you'll find to be a temporary industry?
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to come up before we close this public hearing?
Chairman, I have two things here. One is just a local article from Eastern Oregon, and the other one it's a Washington Post article about what happens to the price of food in third world countries when the price of corn goes up because we decide to fill our tanks with corn.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Is there time for one
quick
more question?
Question? Have,
Mr. Harris, if I could.
Sure.
And
McPherson.
As a user of trucking fuel, so my question is this. If we put in place a renewable fuel standard, which requires you to use a certain proportion of fuel that is, turns out, at least let's just assume, more expensive than using petroleum-based product, do you anticipate any difficulty in passing that cost on then to the consumers of your transportation services?
Interesting enough, with what's happened with the price of fuel over the last 2 years, and the industry has somewhat gotten used to what we call as a fuel surcharge. It's an actual add-on line item fuel surcharge that most trucking companies have been able to pass on to their customers. And that floats up and down. It can either be weekly or monthly or quarterly, depending on whatever the program is. But that has actually been fairly well endorsed by the customer. And I would see that this would probably play into the same thought process. I mean, it's the price of fuel. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, the standards have already been set with this fuel surcharge kind of index in place to be able then to pass it on.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. With that, if there's no other last-minute questions, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2210. And thank you, everybody, for sharing your testimony. And we will move on to House Bill 2211. I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2211 relating to business energy tax credits and House Bill 2212 relating to residential energy tax credits. We have a lot of people who want to testify. I just want to, first of all, make sure everyone knows that we will have continued hearings on Wednesday on both of these bills. So if you don't get a chance to testify today and you haven't come over 100 miles to be here, I will call you up again on Wednesday. But because we have some folks in the audience that have come quite a ways, we're going to call them up first, and then we'll have the governor's office and the Department of Energy, and I think we have economic development that will come afterwards. So with that, it's a great honor to have Chairman Ron Suppa here today with us from the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation. Chairman, thank you for being here, and if you would like to come up along with any other folks from the Warm Springs, it's an honor to have you here today.
Dave Putway, Ron Suppa, Confederated Tribe of the Warm Springs, Chairman of the Tribal Council. Before I begin my testimony, I would like the opportunity maybe to have my staff that I brought along for biomass project to maybe introduce themselves.
Jim Mannion with Warm Springs Power Enterprises.
I'm Cal Mukmoto. I'm the manager for the Warm Springs Biomass LLC.
Mark Jackson with Warm Springs Forest Products Industries.
Thank you.
Where's Jim and Ellen?
Ellen Grover, Kernot Peterson Tribal Council.
Great. Thank you all for being here today. And I just want to let the audience know we will have a brief overview of the bills here in a minute, but I wanted to make sure we had time to hear you all.
Thank you. Again, my name is Ron Suppa, and I am the Tribal Council Chair for Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, for inviting me to come and testify about the legislators' consideration of incentives related to renewable energy generation, including House Bill 2211 relating to the Business Energy Tax Credit, BETSI. The tribe believes that these legislative initiatives are extremely important and beneficial. Renewable energy provides opportunity for direct economic development and in meeting Oregon's and the nation's energy demands. For the tribe, renewable energy projects, and particularly woody biomass, low-income hydropower, wind, and geothermal, represent a significant economic development opportunity that could further the region's diversification of energy production. The tribe's sovereignty, self-governance, and the welfare of our tribal members. The tribe is already an energy producer and has embarked on a course to become a significant supplier of renewable energy in the Pacific Northwest. We currently own a one-third interest in the 440-megawatt Pelton Round Butte hydroelectric project and own the 19-megawatt re-regulating dam hydroelectric project and a 7-megawatt biomass generation facility at the tribe's mill site. Under agreement with Portland General Electric, the tribe will eventually acquire a controlling interest in the Pelton Round Butte project. And as joint licensee, we are spending millions of dollars on project operations to ensure that the hydro operations can be certified as low impact, including investments to improve fish passage, water quality, repairing, and fish habitat and cultural resources. We are actively pursuing an expansion of our biomass generation facility at the Warm Springs Mill to 17 megawatts and are assessing our significant wind and geothermal energy resources on the reservation for commercial development. To realize the full potential of the wind, geothermal, and biomass opportunities on the reservation requires meeting significant challenges. For example, our biomass proposal had to overcome the widely recognized hurdle of securing a stable source of material to fuel the facility. We did this in part by executing a historic MOU with the U.S. Forest Service and BLM related to the management of surrounding federal lands. The biomass facility will help to provide a market-based solution for the serious forest health and fire issues in Oregon and the Northwest. The biomass project is very competitive from a market perspective. We are in substantive negotiations for a power sales agreement and have entertained significant interest from potential equity investors and financing entities. Like many renewable projects, modest federal and state incentives are important in the overall cost structure of the biomass project. The state bit is a critical component of making the biomass project a market reality. The tribes enthusiastically support expansion of the BETC as it relates to renewable energy resources facilities and renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities. Expansion of the BETC to 50% of the certified costs of these facilities and elimination of a reduction in the BETC on a dollar-by-dollar basis against any federal tax incentives, such as the production tax credit, will significantly impact the biomass project financials, as well as any future proposals for wind and geothermal energy on the reservation. Expansion of the BETC will go a long way to ensure that renewable energy projects can be replicated throughout the state. In addition, a significant purpose of the biomass project is to improve forest health by providing a market for the small diameter biomass byproduct from forest health projects. One of the major challenges is managing the financial risks associated with biomass fuel acquisition and supply from these projects. Forest health projects will typically be a more expensive source of biomass than urban wood or mill wood waste residuals because of transportation costs and because it involves intensive hand and mechanical treatments. For your information, I have attached a description of how the tribes propose to manage these different fuel sources. Importantly, expansion of the BETC will strengthen the overall market position of the biomass project. As explained in the attached information, the biomass project must be able to leverage off its market position to be able to source biomass from forest health projects. The BETC expansion will significantly assist this, as will the legislator's biofuels proposal, House Bill 2210. The tribe also enthusiastically supports the biofuels proposal. In other words, these initiatives will have a meaningful impact on forest health in the state. There are a few issues of concern related to the BETC proposals, including, one, the eligibility date for facilities under the new legislation, and two, the rulemaking requirements for renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities. First, it is not clear that a facility which will seek pre-certification this spring and start construction this summer could qualify for the expanded BETC, which, as drafted, would apply to certifications issued on or after the effective date of the Act. As drafted, the Act would have an effective date 91 days after the adjournment of the legislative session. Waiting to start construction to qualify for the BETC under these terms would disqualify the project from the federal production tax credit, which sunsets on December 31st, 2008. The Warm Springs Biomass Project is likely not the only renewable energy project in progress that faces this dilemma. the tribes would request that accommodation to ensure that renewable energy projects that are substantially underway today be able to qualify for the expanded VETC. Second, Section 8 of the legislation requires ODOE to promulgate rules, identify the standards for renewable energy resource equipment and equipment manufactured facilities. The tribe would like to seek clarification that the ODOE could pre-certify and issue final certification for such facilities, even if final rules are not yet promulgated. In other words, the tribes would like to clarify that ODOE could issue such standards by order in advance of final rulemaking. Last, the tribe would like to recognize the leadership role that the state is taking in trying to spur renewable energy development. The tribe has long recognized the benefits that partnerships can attain. The state clearly taken ownership of that partnership concept in the State Agency Renewable Energy Projects Bill, Senate Bill 232, and the State Renewable Energy Legislation, House Bill 2209, and the tribe, again, enthusiastically supports both bills. In conclusion, I cannot overemphasize the importance that renewable energy plays in Oregon's and the tribe's economic future and well-being. Renewable and green energy generation fits well with and supports our tradition, culture, and beliefs. We believe renewable energy generation will become increasingly more attractive in the energy market, but it is still a fact of life that modest federal and state incentives are currently necessary to bring renewable projects to market. I ask these committees to keep that in mind and to continue to support these important incentives. Equally important, however, is try to find ways to create partnerships with other parties, including the state, to capitalize on market solutions where they may exist to maximize the commercial appeal of renewables. As chairman of an energy producing tribe, I pledge to continue to do that. That concludes my testimony. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I certainly appreciate your patience and wanted to know if either the gentleman would like to add any comments to the chairman's testimony.
Not this time.
Okay.
No, I think that covers everything.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I appreciate your patience, and you're welcome to stay for the rest of the hearing if you'd like to hear more. Do we have any quick questions for the chairman before we go on to do a better description of the bill, since I failed to do that, and we'll have the governor's office come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chairman Suppa and the other witnesses, thank you very much for coming over today. I've spent quite a bit of time. Of course, Mr. Mukamoto and I worked together on quite a few different forestry-related matters. But I think what the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation is trying to do here is really cutting edge. They're one of a small handful of groups that are trying to get significant biomass projects going for renewable power, and I really support and thank you for doing that. Just real quick question for you. As you pointed out in your testimony, obviously fuel, the biomass, is a big issue, and I think you've made great progress in that through the MOU with the Federal Land Management Agencies. Capital and equity partners is also very important, which is the purpose of BETC and some of these types of incentives that we're doing. But the other one, the third part of this whole equation, is the power sale contract. And in your testimony, you mentioned that you're in substantive negotiations for power sale agreements. And I was just curious, and, I realize some of this stuff might be proprietary, but could you share with us a little bit how that's going and what kind of progress you're making, please?
Okay. Yeah, we're in negotiations with the two major utilities in the area. And
can you state your name for
the
record?
My name is Cal Mukamoto. I'm the biomass manager the Warm Springs Biomass LLC. I think those are going fine. One of the issues that we do find, and this is the reason why we need a BETC, is that they don't recognize all the attributes of forest biomass power. In fact, there was a study done by the National Renewable Energy Labs about 7 years ago that show that there's about 11.4 cents per kilowatt public benefits for every megawatt per kilowatt of forest biomass power. And market rates for biomass power right now is in the 5 to 6 cent range. So you can see there's a big difference from what the market perceives the value of this based on normal just energy attributes as opposed to all the attributes that forest biomass power probably delivers to the public.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you so much for being here, and it's an honor to have you here, Mr. Chairman. We look very forward to working with you in the future as we work through this legislation and appreciate your comments and input. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next, I will call up Peter Cogswell from the Governor's Office, Mike Greeney from the Department of Energy, and Bob Repine, who's the Director of Oregon Economic and Community Development, to give us a brief background on this bill. Kat, would you like to just give the brief introduction, and then we'll get some more detail from the panel here?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. At this time, I won't really give a summary because I think that Mike Greeney will cover it effectively. I do want to point out, though, members, that you have in front of you some amendments. For HB 2211, you do have a -1 amendment and -2 amendment. And again, I'm going to let Mike describe those briefly. And there is also a -1 amendment for HB 2212 in front of you.
And I did see Bob Repine is there. He is. Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, just that was it. Was
I'm losing weight.
Okay, Peter, you want to start off?
Well, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, it's nice to be here today. For the record, my name is Peter Cogswell, and I'm a senior policy advisor in the governor's office working on energy issues this session along with a few other issues. And I'm really before the committee today. I brought a few experts with me, and Mr. Greeney and Mr. Repine. So I'm just before the committee today to express the governor's strong support for House Bills 2211 and 2212. The modifications that we're proposing to the Business Energy Tax Credit and Residential Energy Tax Credit programs are important components of the governor's legislative package on energy. And collectively, the proposals are aimed at ensuring that Oregon takes advantage of its already strong position to become a leading state in the production and use of renewable energy and alternative fuels. Both bills proposed to build on incentives that Oregon currently offers businesses and individuals for investing in renewable and alternative energy. And they're consistent with the governor's view that to move Oregon forward and remain competitive with other states, we need to keep sending strong signals to developers that we are doing as much or even more than other states in making it cost effective for them to invest in and operate alternative energy projects. In addition, when combined with the renewable energy goals we are proposing in some of our other bills, House Bill 2211 and 2212 send strong signals to renewable energy developers that there will be markets for their products in Oregon. And finally, by extending the incentives to manufacturers of renewable energy technologies, we hope to entice not just developers of alternative energy projects to Oregon, but also the businesses that produce the renewable energy products that are used by those developers. So we believe the expansion of both credits will result directly in more renewable energy being built in Oregon, more renewable energy being used in Oregon, and ultimately more renewable technologies being manufactured in the state. So what I'd like to do now is turn it over to Mike to kind of go into more detail exactly the specifics about the bill. We'd be happy to answer any questions. And Mr. Repine's going to talk more about how OECD hopes to take advantage of these credits to get investments in Oregon.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Mike?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Greeney, Director of the Department of Energy. Our business energy tax credit currently provides a 35% tax credit over 5 years. It's 10% of eligible costs each of the first 2 years and then 5% the next three for energy efficiency and renewable energy. There's two ways to use the tax credit, either directly by a company over those 5 years, or if a company has limited tax liability, it can receive what we call a pass-through payment from another corporation that has tax liability, gets that payment up front for the net present value, which is currently about 25% of the eligible cost. And then that other business, frequently a bank or a utility, can take the tax credit over 5 years. Recently, there's been a hitch in the pass-through payment as a result of the corporate kicker refund, but that's going to be addressed in the Revenue Committee and in separate legislation. So the tax credit has been very important for businesses, especially for energy efficiency. Over 10,000 businesses have used it for energy efficiency investments and nearly 1,000 for renewable energy. House Bill 2211 would increase the percentage of tax credit from 35% to 50% for renewable energy, combined heat and power and fuel cells. It would also increase the eligible project cap from $10 million per project to $20 million. Those are the principal measures. It would also allow manufacturing facilities for components and equipment for renewable energy, such as wind turbines, solar panels, and solar components to qualify for the tax credit. Hydro facilities, which are currently limited to 1 megawatt, could be increased to up to 10 megawatts of, as long as they meet strict state and federal environmental requirements. Home builders could use the tax credit for renewable resources such as solar built into a home or high-performance homes, which is a term of art we use for homes that use very little energy, approach zero net energy homes. Currently, homeowners can use the residential tax credit for that, but typically the decision on what to incorporate is done by the home builder, and this would allow the home builder to do that, and we think would increase those features. Finally, it would end the offset of any federal tax credit received that Chairman Supa mentioned in his testimony as well. The two amendments to the bill, first, there was simply a drafting error, and a blank was left in the description of high-performance homes in the bill that came out. So this clarifies that the criteria would be set by the department in terms of both renewable energy and energy efficiency incorporated, and there's standards in the industry common for that. Secondly, a clarification regarding the investor-owned utilities ability to use participate as pass-through partners in the pass-through program for the tax credit. Let me also mention, in terms of the two concerns that Chief Supa raised, and I appreciate the tribe's support for our bills. First, on the effective date of the certification, it is our intent that projects that receive final certification after January 1st of this year qualify fully for the tax credit. And typically our final certification occurs after the project is completed because we need to know the actual cost, and it could actually be certified after the plant, in this case, begins operation. And just discussions with legislative counsel that I had the other day, I think the language, while it's a little vague, does that. Secondly, regarding his desire that we be able to make determinations specifically even without rulemaking, we do adopt rules for the program, and we'll undoubtedly update our rules if this bill is passed. But that doesn't stop us from making individual determinations for projects coming in, because we can use the statute even if there aren't rules specifically on point. And we've done that, and we'll continue to do that. So be our intent to administer this as quickly as possible. If you'd like, I could mention House Bill 2212 briefly. That one amends our residential energy tax credit, and it's simpler. It has three things, and that program has been very popular as well, especially for solar electric systems and for hybrid vehicles and for energy-efficient appliances. It would allow the tax credit for more than one system, whether it's a solar system or multiple appliances, in 1 year, as long as you made the individual qualifying purchases for those systems. It would also increase from $1,500 to $6,000 over a four-year period the tax credit for fuel cells and wind generation for homeowners, comparable to what you did for solar electric systems last session. And these are high-cost items for which the current level of the tax credit really doesn't provide a meaningful incentive. And then it would also apply, again, January 1st of 07. The amendment is simply a technical correction to clarify that, again, our intent was to allow multiple systems qualify in 1 year. In reviewing the bill as drafted, our attorney advised us that it wasn't clear enough and that adjust the language further. Be happy to answer any questions now or at subsequent hearings, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Greeney. And we'll hear from Mr. Repine, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Bob Repine. I'm Director of Economic and Community Development. I've had my testimony circulated to you, Madam Chair, and all the committee members. In the interest of time, what I think I'd like to share with you, the time I do have with you, is you have heard from every panel whether or not they were talking about 2210 or now hearing about 2211 and 2212. There is a huge economic component embedded in each one of those pieces of legislation. I've given you on my talking piece of paper some statistical information about the business tax credits and residential tax credits, the number that have been accomplished over the last biennium, what are projected to come about in 2007, 2009. But I think the message I want to share with you is that we in Oregon, as you all are aware of, are in a very highly competitive marketplace for recruiting businesses. And this has become a huge, particularly the Betsy tax credit has been a huge piece of our successes of landing companies in Oregon who have expressed interest in locating here, but also have huge efficiencies that they want to develop within their manufacturing and processing that allows them to take advantage and utilize these Betsy tax credits. To be able to move that bar up considerably, as has been proposed by Mr. Graney, would make a significant increase stake opportunity for us as we go out and indulge those companies about wanting to locate in Oregon for real reasons and also show them that we have tools that really make it justifiable for them. The other part I wanted to share with you is, and many of you were part of the Oregon conference that was just held in January this year up in Portland, where sustainability and energy issues is a centerpiece of that discussion. Not only is it part of the Business Council's activities, but also part of Oregon Innovation, which is another piece of legislation that you'll see coming through that really highlights the issue and importance of energy and renewable energies as being a centerpiece of Oregon's future. I would tell you that clearly in the governor's messages and what we see in our own backyards and our own communities, there is a huge appetite for energy activities, both in the fuels, both in energy efficiencies, both in house and residential. These all fit together because relative to the residential piece, if we aren't willing to support and promote environmental issues around residential, it's real difficult to recruit and acquire businesses who want to make the components that go in residential housing opportunities if we aren't very strong supporters of it. Today, we're recruiting at least three companies that are highly leveraged, highly productive industry developers in the environmental part of solar energy. And to be able to show that you have a strong relationship in your residential market on making that opportunity for people to put this type of equipment on their houses or in their houses also just sends a stronger message to them that we're really sincere, we're really believing in their industry as a contributor to the economy of the state of Oregon. Again, we're at the cutting edge of this, and you've heard that, and there are some potential things we don't know about, very possible. But I think we all are agreeing that in the future, the energy issues will be a centerpiece of our state. And as we try to compete with other states, we have to be at the forefront of that discussion. And I think these pieces of legislation position us very well.
Thank you. Thank you so much, gentlemen. I appreciate all of your comments and want to see if there's any questions before we move on to the next panel. So, Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Mike Graney. I notice in the 2211 that the credit is applied, that the 50% credit is applied over 5 years at 10% per year, whereas under the current 35, you explained it's 10, 10, 5, 5, 5, recognizing that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar a business expects to get tomorrow. What was the thinking behind, or was there any thinking behind, spreading that out over 5 years rather than front-loading the credit at the start?
I'm sure, Representative Cannon, I think our decision was based simply on, you know, following the existing pattern. Certainly, we'd be open to different combinations. There might be a different revenue impact, but we could certainly look at that.
Thank you. Representative Gurley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Graney, first of all, the issue about this date with the credit is not real clear to me, so I did ask the tribes to send me some more information on it. I understand you're going to meet with them this afternoon. I want to make sure that we get the date for the certification and we're absolutely clear as to when that is and that it qualifies for these projects that are in the pipeline right now. I do have a specific question about what we're trying to do in this bill. On page 3...
And could you clarify, is this House Bill 2211 or 2212?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It is 2211.
Since we're officially hearing on both bills.
Right. Forgive me. 2211, page 3, lines 9 through 16.
Correct. Madam Chair, Representative Burley, this deals with the what we call the high-performance home, and that's a very energy-efficient home, would allow home builders to qualify for the tax credit. So they could receive the tax credit by building these features into new or, in the case of major remodeling, existing homes. Currently, homeowners can qualify for the tax credit under the residential tax credit. Typically, except for homes that, you know, the homeowner is designing themselves, there aren't many opportunities for that, whereas to take advantage of that. So this is an issue that we've discussed with the home builders as an opportunity for them to actively plan and incorporate features in more homes as they're building. And this, we would do the same for solar and other renewable energy as well in another section of the bill, I believe, does the same thing.
Follow up. Representative Burley.
And that's great. I know that that's been an issue that we've been trying to resolve. I've always raised the question, and I mean no offense to anybody, but I just wanted to make sure that if the home builder gets the credit, that, you know, say it's a $10,000 credit, that is reflected somehow in the sale price of the house. And I think the language in here where they must notify the buyer, the consumer of the house, the purchaser, certainly does level that playing field. And full disclosure, I think that's good. I'm glad to see this. I think this resolution language is pretty good. So I thank you for that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And my understanding, I mean, this is to prevent any double dipping, so to speak. Make sure that there are not two tax credits being claimed on the same property. Can you just
That's
talk
correct.
A little bit about implementation, how you will enforce that, Director Greeney?
Madam Chair, because this is a business energy tax credit, we do have to certify both what we call a preliminary certification, which gives us a general idea of the project, and then the final certification after the project is complete. So we can get, and those have to be on file with us, so we'll be able to track the tax credit and make sure that there is no double dipping. And a residential tax credit coming in for the same address would trigger a red flag.
Okay.
So I think we can catch that.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And don't go too far, because I'm sure there may be more questions today or tomorrow. So I'm going to call up the final panel. And then just to let folks know, we'll have a full day on Wednesday to hear the remainder of testimony. But I want to make sure the people who came over 100 miles here today are heard from, and I will call up Jan Lee, who is with the Northwest. Well, no, I have down. You're with the Suwali Irrigation District.
Yes, and Mr. Johnson is with me.
Okay. Would you like those to come up? Thank you. And then I don't have anybody else that's more than 100 miles, but I know that Myron Burr said he couldn't make it on Wednesday, so I said we would have him come up here today. And then also I will call up have Kevin Lynch from PPM Energy, so I don't know if you want to sit in the little cage up here on deck. I hate using baseball analogies. But then I have to talk about the Mets, which is my team. So welcome, and it's great to see you here. Actually, Jan and I actually served together in the 2001 session, and so very pleased to see you here. Thank you, Jan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Jan Lee, the manager of Suwali Irrigation District, and I also work with the Northwest Hydro Association. We are building a 5.1-mile pipeline in our irrigation district that will provide 27 cubic feet per second of water permanently in stream in the Deschutes River. That's about a quarter of the district's water right. At the end of that pipeline, we'll be developing a 1-megawatt hydro plant. The water that we're using is the same water that we already divert for irrigation at the same period of time, so there will be no increase in the water right that's already been approved back in 1899. We divert from the river with a 2004 state-of-the-art fish screen So I'm sure that we will be able to meet all of the various requirements from the federal and state agencies. We're also constructing the hydro plant actually within the canal. It's called an inline conduit, so that the water is in the canal, goes through the turbine generator, out the other side further down the canal, and does not discharge into the river, creating any kind of a pollution impact. There are a number of projects like this one in the various districts, cities, ports, etc. About 6 years ago, I did a preliminary survey, and there were about 100 megawatts of small hydro, which is hydro under 10 megawatts. These entities, although most of them are public entities, can use the Betsy tax credits, the business energy tax credit, because they can use the pass-through provisions. So we're very supportive of maintaining the pass-through structure, because that's really the part of the bill that helps us out. And if you look at Section 3B of the bill, expanding the energy tax credit to 10% a year over the five-year period, that makes some of these projects, which have both water conservation and energy benefits, that much more effective to do. And in our community in Bend, we certainly have a shortage of water, so we are trying to, as a group, rebuild the amount of water that can be left in stream in the river, and that's a part of this project as well as most of the others. The district projects are also exempt under the Northwest Power Planning Council provisions because they are at existing diversions and are screened. At the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission back in Washington, D.C., our projects have a special exemption because they're under 5 or 15 megawatts depending on the provisions, and they do exist at diversion facilities. So in summary, I urge your support of House Bill 2211. I have seen some amendments from the Oregon Environmental Council, and I also support those. I had assumed that those provisions were inherent in the bill to protect fishery, et cetera, so I have no problem with those. And certainly appreciate the clarification from Director Graney about the effective date, because that was one thing I was worried about already being in the process. I would be glad to answer any questions later. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan, and I really appreciate your comments. Mr. Johnson, would you like to add anything?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm the manager of the Central Oregon Irrigation District, and we're located in Redmond. We currently own and operate a 5.5-megawatt hydroelectric facility on the Deschutes River in Bend, and it generates enough renewable green power per year for approximately 2,500 homes.
And Steve, can you state your name for the record, please?
Yes. Steve Johnson.
Thank you. We have people who are listening and want to make sure they know who's speaking. Thank you.
This plant, it has produced since its in-service date in 1989 over 240 million kilowatt hours of power. This plant came online after many years of planning and was feasible only because the market pricing at that time included an energy price of 7.05 cents per kilowatt hour plus a capacity payment, and that was favorable enough to go forward. This same facility would not be possible to build in the same manner today unless there was supplemental project funding. The current electric power pricing available in the market is now lower than it was 18 years ago. The current power price for a qualified facility defined renewable energy project is less than 6 cents per kilowatt hour and carries no capacity payments. So for example, Pacific Core's 2008 weighted average pricing for 2008 is 5.16 cents per kilowatt hour, and PGE's is also less than 6 cents. The cost of design, construction, interconnection, licensing, and legal for hydroelectric projects have dramatically risen since our last hydro project and represent a substantial percentage of total project costs. For a sense of perspective, out of the $15 million bond issued for our hydro project in 89, approximately $4 million, or 27%, were for these additional costs. COID is now wishing to proceed with piping over 2 miles of open canal with a 3.2 megawatt hydroelectric facility. This facility will use the water that we already divert for irrigation to generate electricity and then continue onward in the open canal to farmland, similar to the design that Jan just shared with you. An additional benefit of this project is that it will provide 20 cubic feet per second of permanently conserved water transferred to the Deschutes River. And the diversion from the river for our canal has a certified U.S. Fish Wildlife Service and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife fish screen constructed in 2004. Our new hydro facility has the estimated total cost, including financing costs, of approximately $22 million. Existing market prices alone do not support its construction and is therefore not viable unless this legislation passes. In addition, this proposed facility does not qualify for the existing BETSI or Business Energy Tax Credit because it is hydro and in excess of 1 megawatt. No other renewable energy resource carries this limitation. In addition, the Oregon Public Utilities Commission and docket UM 1129 has recognized qualified facilities for all renewable energy resources of up to 10 megawatts in size. So in reference on the comments that you should have in front of you, Section 1C recognizes the need for an increase of percentage to make renewable energy projects viable. Section 3B on page 5 corrects the problem of eligibility for hydroelectric while carrying the necessary and appropriate safeguards of protection for fish and wildlife. Section 3BI recognizes the 10 megawatt of eligible capacity and aligns with the Public Utility Commission docket. And Section 4.1A, page 6, it just recognizes the costs of projects have risen over time and the need to provide a higher dollar base of eligibility. Urge your support for HB 2211 as it applies to hydroelectric projects, and glad to answer any questions you may have later.
Thank you so much. We'll move in to Mr. Burr and Mr. Lynch, and then we'll see if there's any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I have copies of my testimony here. If someone could distribute those, please.
For the record, can you please state your name?
Yes.
Affiliation.
Yes. For the record, my name is Myron Burr. I'm an environmental engineer with Celtronic Corporation. I have over 25 years' experience in the energy and environmental fields, including renewable energy projects such as geothermal, biomass, and wind. As an engineer for Celtronic, I want to give you just a bit of background about Celtronic. We're a 25-year member of the Oregon community. We employ nearly 1,000 people manufacturing silicon wafers for the electronics industry for companies like Intel. We sell to Intel. We're actively engaged in sustainable manufacturing practices. We believe this approach is good for our business and our ability to provide good jobs in Oregon. It's also good for the environment and good for the community in which we operate. As my manager says, he said many times, sustainability is not our responsibility, it's our future. So, you know, we take this very seriously, and this particular bill is caught our interest because we've made use of the provisions in the BETSI program, and I'll just talk a little bit about why we support this bill, but we support it with a couple of recommendations for improvement. The first one has to do with energy efficiency. Director Graney mentioned that the BETSI program has an energy efficiency element. If you look at Oregon PUC data, you'll see that energy efficiency projects cost about 1.3 cents per kilowatt hour, which is about one-third the cost of new wind resources at 4.3 cents per kilowatt hour. So energy efficiency is a very cost-effective resource compared to our other options. Currently, the BETSI program provides a 35% tax credit for qualifying energy efficiency projects, as you've heard. Celtronic recently used this program to install a new heat recovery unit, which now saves 1.93 million kilowatt hours of electricity, 156,000 therms of natural gas, and 1,300 tons a year of greenhouse gases. On a per unit production basis, we have reduced our greenhouse gas emissions by 38% in the last 3 years. On an absolute basis, the numbers aren't quite that high, but we still have reduced our greenhouse gases by 8% during this period. These energy savings have helped our company become more competitive in the global marketplace, enabling us to provide good jobs for Oregonians. We have several other possible projects that could save in excess of an additional 460,000 kilowatt hours, 132,000 therms, and 1,800 tons of greenhouse gases per year. those projects are on the drawing board, and they would be greatly benefited from being included in this new bill in terms of energy efficiency projects. So the bottom line is that the BETSI program is a great tool to leverage immediate investment in these cost-effective and pollution-reducing energy resources. A recently completed Energy Trust study found that roughly another 400 megawatts of energy efficiency resources may be cost-effectively available in Oregon. This would eliminate the need to spend money on a new coal or natural gas power plant and avoid the greenhouse gases associated with such a plant. Imagine what great strides Oregon would make in these areas if we could capture more of these opportunities. We strongly urge you to capitalize on these opportunities by simply including energy efficiency projects in the BETSI bill. Not doing so would unnecessarily hamstring our state and our business capabilities. It would limit our competitiveness and delay urgently needed action on these key energy and environmental issues. So that's the first point I wanted to make, and that has to do with including energy efficiency projects in this bill.
And, Mr. Meyer, I have to let you know we have about 3 more minutes before we're going to get kicked out of this room.
I'll be done in 2.
Okay, thank you.
Recycling is the second recommendation we want to talk about, and it has to do with many recycling projects result in less energy use and lower greenhouse gas emissions. Just one of our projects saves over 1,300 tons of greenhouse gases per year and has totaled nearly 3,500 tons to date. So with regard to recycling, there's just 2 issues. First is that recycling is not included in the bill. We believe it should be in order to capture these opportunities. The second one is that way Betsy's currently structured, if the raw materials are not returned to the original process, then the recycling project would not qualify for the tax credit. And many of the raw materials that are used in manufacturing processes are highly energy intensive, and it would be a shame not to have these materials go back to the original process, and not we would be reducing the energy usage and the emissions associated with those resources if we miss that opportunity. So we need to broaden the language on recycling projects. And to wrap up, I understand that one of the issues with regard to the bill and why it's written so narrowly is a budget issue. So we recommend that rather than increasing the cap on the project from $10 million to $20 million, if you left it at $10 million, that might address the budget issue and allow for the inclusion of energy efficiency and recycling projects. In summary, we believe it's a good bill. We support it. However, we do recommend these modifications, and we strongly urge you to consider them in your deliberations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I apologize for rushing you. Mr. Lynch, are you able to come back on Wednesday? I don't want to rush you, but we literally have to be out of this room in about 2 minutes. So if you're able to come back, I certainly want to hear your full testimony. Are there any quick questions for this panel?
It's good seeing you, Representative Lee.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. We appreciate you coming all the way from Central Oregon, and certainly appreciate your comments. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2211 and 2212 and the House Energy and Environment Committee.